welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. I'm Michele Matarazzo, and today we'll be talking about one of the most challenging symptoms in Parkinson's disease, which is freezing of gait. And in particular, we are going to talk about those cases that don't improve with dopaminergic medication. Joining me is Dr. Nicolas Bonen, senior author of a recent paper published in Movement Disorders titled Cholinergic System Changes in DOPA Unresponsive Freezing of Gait in Parkinson's Disease. Dr. Bonen is professor of radiology and neurology at the University of Michigan and also worked at the Ann Arbor VA Medical Center. And he is also a leading expert on neuroimaging and cholinergic function in Parkinson's disease. Nico, welcome to the podcast and thank you for being with us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so I would like to start with the clinical part of this story. Freezing of gait is one of the most challenging and probably frustrating manifestations of Parkinson's disease, not just for patients, which of course are the ones affected by it, but also for clinicians. And while some patients respond to levodopa or to dopaminergic medication, others don't, or a lot of patients who initially respond to levodopa end up not responding to levodopa. Now, can you briefly explain how common DOPA unresponsive freezing of gait is and why it is such a critical unmet need for our field?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so levodopa is the biggest miracle what we have achieved in Parkinson's disease. But we should realize that the honeymoon with levodopa, if you take a rough number, plus or minus, is about 5 years. So initially, whatever dopaminergic medication you use, you're the excellent doctor. But after 5 years, when the honeymoon starts to fade away and things become more serious, you're no longer that miracle doctor because you're dealing with symptoms that simply L-DOPA does no longer or ineffectively treat. And that can be dementia, which is actually one of the most debilitating complications, a non-motor symptom in Parkinson's, but also falls and freezing of gait. We call them these midline or axial motor impairments. And if you ask people about the quality of life and you take the Hoon and Yar staging schema from one stage 1 mile to stage 5 bedridden, it's the transition when postural instability develops at stage 2.5 and 3 that people's quality of life really goes down. And then at the same time, when we see those balance and gait problems developing, it more or less goes hand in most patients with development of cognitive impairment and then ending up in dementia. Initially, freezing of gait may be present in a smaller subset of patients, but if you live long enough with Parkinson's, and we have these long prospective cohort studies up to 20 years, up to 80% will have dementia as well as falls and freezing of gait. And how do you treat that population? And that's where L-DOPA is failing you. And so that's the clinical unmet need we have in Parkinson's disease. Freezing of gait is very debilitating. Imagine you want to take a step, and despite that you try everything, you fail to do. And one of the most important things we do in our life is so-called goal-directed motor behavior. We stand up and we have a goal to move. There's a motivation to pick something up or do something. And then if you want to do that, to lead a functionally independent life, if you cannot move, that's really a serious problem that we're dealing with.
Great. Thank you for this background. It's really clear that being unable to walk affects and impacts severely the quality of life of our patients. And also, as you were mentioning, the risk of falls, they have sometimes very severe consequences for them. Now, it is clear to me why you wanted to study this. But let me ask you, you were already touching a little bit of the next question, which is not everything is about dopamine in Parkinson's disease. There are other things. Now, why did you decide to study acetylcholine in freezing of gait? What is the evidence of the link between these two pieces of the puzzle of what Parkinson's is?
Yeah, so first of all, there is actually significant previous literature that exposure to anti-muscarinic, anticholinergic drugs is a big predictor for freezing of gait. And postmortem studies show that exposure to anticholinergic medications is also associated with developing misfolded proteins from Alzheimer's disease, like plaques and tangles. And what we know about this advancing disease when levodopa is no longer your friend is that there is increasing comorbidity of misfolded protein on top of the alpha-synuclein that it's packed in the Lewy bodies, but also we see a variable degree of Alzheimer's co-pathology. And in a very naive and overly simplistic model, when I was in medical school, they said that Parkinson's is a loss of dopamine, and then Alzheimer's disease is a loss of acetylcholine. And when I started my career using cholinergic PET imaging, one of the very first studies I did was actually compare Alzheimer's to Parkinson's. And not only Parkinson's with dementia, but Parkinson's without dementia with mild cognitive impairment. And guess what? The average loss of acetylcholine in the brain was even higher, believe it or not, except for the hippocampus, in even patients with mild cognitive impairment in Parkinson's. What is the paradox is Alzheimer's disease only develop severe cholinergic losses in the very end stage of the disease. So it's a late phenomenon in Alzheimer's, but it got all the attention of the literature. While we have been focusing for 60 years in dopaminocentric view of Parkinson's disease and simply forgetting about existing postmortem data dating back to the early 1980s, showing exactly what I also found in my in vivo imaging data. So it's nothing new. It simply was neglected.
So it's been there the whole time. We just, well, another difference is that now we have the tool to measure it better. And actually that links to my next question, because of course, PET imaging to study the cholinergic system in the brain has long been used in the past, not only years, but decades. But now you're using a different tracer, which is a little bit more modern, which is the FEOBV. Can you tell me a little bit more about that specifically and how it compares with other tracers that have been used in the past?
Yeah, so the other tracers, for example, the cholinesterase PET ligands, remember the drugs we use for treating cognitive impairment and dementia is cholinesterase inhibitors. And those are complicated drugs with a lot of problems. So we will not go into that in detail, but the first thing to do so, if you want to measure acetylcholinesterase in the brain, was actually radiolabel one of those medications or derivatives. And that's what they did like 25 or 30 years ago. And what you see then is when you look at acetylcholinesterase PET scan, the most intense activity of acetylcholine nerve terminals in the brain is the same as a dopamine scan is in the basal ganglia. It's actually relatively low in the cortex where everybody pays attention. But the basal ganglia is the big sleeping elephant in the room here again. It's very intense in terms of nerve terminal activity. The problem with cholinesterase inhibitors, and unless you do complicated technology with PET scans, inserting arterial line and sample blood parameters, which many patients don't like if you do that, you cannot reliably quantify the most important, at least the most intense structure in the brain, the basal ganglia. And for that same reason, the basal ganglia, the cerebellum. So it's really a handicap. So what people have done is, when you look at the nerve terminal, most that we know that a neurotransmitter is synthesized. But then before the neurotransmitter can be released to the synaptic cleft, it needs to be packaged into small vesicles that are present in the presynaptic nerve terminal cytoplasm and are transporters in the cytoplasm bound on those vesicles. We call them the vesicular transporters. They exist for dopamine. They exist for, let's say, every neurotransmitter we use. We need to package it in vesicles. So the one for the acetylcholine is called the vesicular acetylcholine transporter. And it simply tells the capacity how much acetylcholine we can pack in a vesicle. So once the vesicle is released into the cleft, the more acetylcholine is in the vesicles, the more acetylcholine you can release. But compared to other ligands that focus on receptors, this is a very stable marker that doesn't change much. If you take even, let's say, a medication, it may impact the release. It's only minimally affected. So it's a very reliable marker, as if you want, if you will, the density of the presynaptic nerve terminals, then go with a vesicular transporter PET scan. We have them for dopamine, for the monoamines, we have them for acetylcholine, for norepinephrine, etc.
Mm-hmm. You had the possibility of looking into those very relevant areas of the brain, especially for Parkinson's disease, at least as we know it, how important those areas, such as the striatum, for example, for Parkinson's. That's fantastic. Now let's get into the results a little bit. So you found a distinct pattern of cholinergic denervation in dopa-responsive freezing of gate group as compared to the dopa-responsive one. Can you walk us through the main regions affected and how this pattern differs from the people who had freezing but did respond to levodopa?
Yeah, indeed. So in a study, we compared patients who had levodopa-resistant in a freezing of gait and compared them to those who still responded to levodopa. So you really can zoom in on the areas that are significant between the groups. And this included the insula, the hippocampus, the fimbria of the hippocampus, the metathalamus, particularly the lateral geniculate nuclei. Then we had the posterior cingulate, the antroventral nucleus of the thalamus, also known as part of the motor thalamus, if you will. And then the putamen and left mid-temporal region. If you look at this region, and if you want to divide the cortex, if you will, in limbic versus neocortical or paralimbic, this is mainly limbic and paralimbic structures. So limbic is hippocampus, for example, posterior cingulum, and insula is your key paralimbic structures. And what we know from human brain studies is the most dense cholinergic innervations by the nucleus basalis of minors are the limbic and paralimbic structures. And what they do is the function of acetylcholine, if you want to put it in simplistic terms, it's like looking for meaningful clues in your life. For example, if you have a dog, when you're eating, the dog pays attention, is really focused to the point that the dog may get some food, for example. So that's a meaningful clue for the animal. But we do more or less the same thing in life. Right? We look for meaningful clues that are relevant for us, and we need to pay selective attention to those and ignore all the other noise of sensory stimuli where we live in. And that's the function of acetylcholine, is paying attention, filtering out noise, so that we have goal-directed behaviors. This is what I want, and I detected the cue, let's pursue it, let's get up and moving. So this goal-directed motor behavior is very important in life. And this is actually where the limbic cortex and paralimbic cortex is they put this level of motivation to the sensory input. It's more like a motivational sensory processing structures that they say, this is what I want to do. I need my hippocampus, tell me where I have to move with my navigation, and then I go there and I achieve my goal. And that's actually most of what we do in life. We have goals. Yeah.
This is actually very interesting. And I have a few follow-up questions to this. So the first one is, when my mind think about the cholinergic function in the brain and what happens in Parkinson's disease, there has always been this link between, you were mentioning before, the nucleus basalis of Meynert, but more with the cognitive part, and maybe the PPN more with the gait problems. Now, you're talking about the nucleus basalis of Meynert with the freezing of gait. Are you implying that the freezing of gait is more of a cognitive problem, or maybe we've been looking at this wrong all along, and there is no such a clear-cut distinction between nucleus basalis of Meynert, cognition, PPN, gait, and this much more complex thing?
Yeah, so the same as a philosophical question, is a fall a motor problem or is a fall a cognitive problem? And the answer is, we cannot be dualistic here. We cannot go back several centuries ago and have dualism in medicine. What we see is this is really fully integrated cognitive and motor, sensory and emotional processing in goal-directed behaviors. And this is different from automatism of movements. We can take like a locomotor region and stimulate that locomotor region that's in the cerebellum or the PPN or the subthalamic nucleus or even the spinal cords, and you get automatic stepping. You can even take the cortex away in cats. They've done those cats without a brain. And if you stimulate those areas and keep the cat alive, they still walk for you. But that's automatism of movements. But this is quite different from goal-directed behaviors. You need to input all that information, the motivation to move. You need to make sure that in a busy indoor living setting, you don't bump into things, bump into other people. Watch out for the cat in front of your feet. So you need to put that information in for safe, goal-directed inner motivation. And that's no longer automatic. And that's the big difference between those basic locomotor centers. So in this aspect, with freezing of gait, and if you look at the regions we find that are refractory, it's the areas that we need for cognitive, motor, and multisensory processing, and at the same time put an emotional valence to it. You have a vigor, a reason, motivation to move. And the processing level happens in interactions with the cortex, but the striatum plays a big role. The complex thing is, you say, why don't we see that intense uptake in the striatum? When we compare freezers to non-freezers, we see all those changes being abnormal at the cholinergic level in the striatum very extensively. But this is the difference between non-responsive versus responsive freezing. And it's no longer the emphasis on the striatum, but really on this higher cortical level, multisensory cognitive motor attentional integration. Mix it in with emotional factors. Even fear of falling plays also a role in freezing of gait. And that happens at the higher cortical levels.
Great. That makes a lot of sense. And of course, we started this conversation from the clinical part. Now, I would like to go back to that. Do you think that the results that you're showing can help us finding a way to help the patients who are suffering from these manifestations of Parkinson's?
Yeah, so indeed, I think what we as clinicians can do is, number one is, and it's very easy, it's simply de-prescribing anything that has anticholinergic MA drugs that pass the blood-brain barrier. Let's say, think about these anti-muscarinic medications we use for the bladder. There are a number of them that simply don't cross or very little cross the blood-brain barrier. Switch them from a selective peripheral anti-muscarinic drug. That can do miracles already in improving the cholinergic system. A lot of medications we use in medicine, like warfarin, Lasix, antidepressants, have anticholinergic side effects. And if you don't know that they even have anticholinergic side effects, people keep on prescribing them. But I have to alert internal medicine doctors about it and then give them advice to take away this medication. That's the low-hanging fruit. Then the question is, what about cholinesterase inhibitors? Mm-hmm. And I mentioned cholinesterase inhibitors are complex drugs. They simply, in a non-specific way, increase the amount of acetylcholine at the synaptic cleft. But they both stimulate and inhibit certain presynaptic and postsynaptic receptors. So you have a dilution of effects. It's not really primed to one specific receptor subtype. But I did studies myself years ago. I mentioned a study in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's that I compared them. And we did a trial, and we gave the patients donepezil. And the FDA approved donepezil based on 100% blockage of acetylcholinesterase in the red blood cells. And what I found in the studies, it only got in the brain at the best in 20-25% in patients in the brain. And if the average blocking was more than 25%, let's say 30%, then I saw cognitive benefits on attention memory. But anybody below, let's say 22, had zero benefit. We use medications that weakly get in the brain and that are also non-selective. So there is actually, and that's, I'm very happy to see the new literature expanding. We have no recent approval in the US, not in neurology, but in psychiatry, and to treat patients with psychosis, we have schizophrenia with a muscarinic 1 and muscarinic 4 agonist. And they were smart. They combined that with a medication, trospium, that blocks the peripheral muscarinic receptors, for example, on the bladder, but it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier or very little. And that is an approach to maximize a specific drug that acts on specific muscarinic receptor subtypes, get it in the brain, and don't worry about peripheral dose-limiting side effects that we see, for example, with cholinesterase inhibitors. Another example, which is my hidden pearl in the literature that I found, and probably many of the listeners are also aware of it, if I have a patient that doesn't respond to levodopa anymore with freezing of gait, I go to the roticotine patch. And the roticotine patch is a dopamine 1, still partially D2, D3, dopamine receptor agonist. But studies also have shown that if you use measures of acetylcholine in the brain, for example, with TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation techniques, to see how certain pulses are being transmitted in the brain and quantify that roticotine actually improves actually this processing at the cholinergic level in the brain that many people don't ever realize. So that is a drug in place of all, but we should not even forget about an old drug done by Cathy Chung and Jay Nutt in Oregon, at Portland, Oregon, years ago, 2010, where they used donepezil in frequently falling patients with Parkinson's disease. They had a 50% reduction in falls. And remember, a lot of falls in Parkinson's are due to freezing of gait. That's actually one of the main reasons to fall. But it's only in patients with frequent falls. And they did a study with another promising drug from Takeda called TAK-0171, which is a muscarinic type 1 receptor allosteric modulator in Parkinson's disease, where they even had a predictor for falls called gait variability, how irregular is your gait. And they also had as a secondary outcome cognition. And the study failed to find a reduction of this drug in for the gait fall predictor, but they included patients who had fallen at least once per year. And the study was underpowered to look at patients who had multiple falls and probably were half freezing of gait. But interestingly, this drug significantly improved cognition, AMI globally, and in particularly executive functions, including spatial navigation tasks and divided attention inhibition tests. So this is all in the literature. It's just published in JAMA Neurology earlier this year. But this is the line of medications that now coming to the clinic, those selective muscarinic agonists. And for example, I mentioned xanomeline, the M1, M4 agonist, we can actually treat them. We even have old drugs, varenicline, and we did a study with varenicline that stimulates alpha-4 beta-2 nicotinic receptors in the brain in Parkinson's. And we didn't look for freezing of gait, but we looked, for example, at the difference of stepping while you're doing cognitive motor dual tasking, and actually improved on that. So varenicline is an existing drug that potentially could be repurposed to test in clinical trials in freezing of gait. And last but not least, there is a drug from 2014 by Andrew Lieberman, where they had nicotine bitartrate. And he said, what is nicotine bitartrate? You can actually, in the US at least, go to a gas station and buy it in e-cigarettes. I'm not promoting them here, just clear. In the nicotine gums and nicotine, whatever they use for nicotine preparations, they use at clinical for anti-smoking. But he did a study with a dose, with pulsatile, and that's important with nicotine now. It needs to be pulsatile, otherwise your receptors get misregulated. Nicotine building up from a low dose over 10 weeks, 4 times per day, to I believe 10 weeks. And what they found was they saw a significant reduction in the number of falls and the freezing episodes. So in other words, we don't have to wait for fancy new drugs. If you're willing to commit funds for repurposing, there is some low-hanging fruit here.
That leads me to my probably last question. Are you going to do these trials? Or who is going to do these trials?
Yeah, and that's the big problem. We will fund trials. That's if you have a pharmaceutical company, they have a self-interest to fund it for also the repurposing, you need to have charity or foundation funding. And with the nicotine, you have to be careful because we know that Parkinson's patients have a propensity for sometimes addiction. For example, with levodopa in a few percent of patients. So we have to watch out with the nucleus accumbens and dopamine. And also remember, when we speak about acetylcholine, it's not a separate box from dopamine. If somebody would use nicotine, you stimulate dopamine, actually. So dopamine and acetylcholine are not separate circuitry. They're actually, at the molecular level, they interact with each other. They're like two partners in a dance. And what we see, in essence, that early on in Parkinson's disease, acetylcholine upregulates. That's an old hypothesis from 60 years ago. We call that the seesaw or balance. But then later in the disease, we showed the studies that initially in Parkinson's, there's higher than normal acetylcholine level, including the basal ganglia and the forebrain, etc. But then we lose that compensation, and that's when those problems start kicking in. Acetylcholine can no longer compensate.
And do you foresee PET imaging, like FEOBV, for example, as a criteria to include or not include or to treat or not treat patients with this compounds, novel compound or repurposed compounds?
Yeah, it depends on the molecular target of your treatment. I would go, if you have muscarinic, I would go with a muscarinic receptor, for example, or nicotinic receptor. And because we have subtype selective muscarinic as well as nicotinic PET ligand. So I would go with the molecular target. I'd have target engagement, but you could use the technique for pre-selection of patients to make sure they're not hyper than normal, that the ones who are compensating. I don't want to give these medications to where the acetylcholine is upregulated. You have to select those who have become hypocholinergic.
Thank you very much. Is there anything else you want to share with our listeners?
No, that's all. I would like to thank you, Emmy, for this interview, and thank you to the listeners for listening.
Mikhail, thank you so much for joining us today and for walking us through this very interesting study. And for those of you interested, remember that the full paper is available in Movement Disorders. Thanks again for tuning in into the MDS podcast. See you next time.
If you enjoyed the conversation about this paper, you can further your experience with continuing medical credits, or CMEs. You can find the link to the journal CME course for this paper within the episode description on the MDS website. Journal CME is planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society is accredited by the ACCME to provide a continuing medical education for physicians. The International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society designates this education activity for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders, and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.